In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about revenue expansion opportunities. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 365. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. And for this week, Rob, tell me the two most recent non-mainstream board games you've played.
Oh, my goodness. This is you're putting me on the spot. All right.
I am.
Most recent non-mainstream board games, repeating the question to stall. I played the Legend of Drizzt board game, which is like this $65 behemoth massive thing with these figures in it. And it's set in kind of what the D&D world. And Drizzt is a character who's been in a bunch of books, fantasy books by R.A. Salvatore. And so it is pretty cool. And it's like a simplified version of D&D in essence, right? You don't have all the rules and the mechanics, but it's kind of a nice, it's a lot quicker because you can kind of play around in an hour or something. The other game, I back a lot of games on Kickstarter, so I could probably name five that are just super non-mainstream, but there's one called Mini Mint Tin Apocalypse, and it's tiny. It was like $2 or $3. And it is literally a mint tin and then like a couple wooden meeples and then just some six-sided die. So I recommend it for like, it's cool because it takes like 10 or 15 minutes to play and it takes like 5 or 10 minutes to learn. So it's not something that's long-term you're going to play all the time, but it is when I know we just have a few minutes, you sit down and you can just hammer it out. So it's kind of fun and it's super cheap.
So aside from the board games, what else is new?
Well, from the time this podcast airs, I will be wheels up to MicroConf Europe 2 days later, and I'm excited to get to Lisbon. We're going to have folks speaking like Peldy Glazoni from Balsamic, Andres Purdy, who is the former head of marketing for Pipedrive. He now has his own company called OutFunnel. We have Craig Hewitt from Podcast Motor, Mike Tabor from Bluetick, Moitza Mars, Facebook ad expert, and we have several other speakers. So excited to get there and see some folks that we maybe haven't seen for a year, as well as meet the new attendees who are coming for the first time.
Awesome. Well, on my end, when this podcast comes out, there will be an announcement for the tickets will be available, but I will be speaking at FemtoConf over in Germany in the spring. So I believe it is the first week of March. It's like March 2nd to 4th. It's over the weekend, so it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And the tickets are actually going live the day that this episode goes out. So if you head over to FemtoConf.com, I'm told that they should be available, and if they're not, it's not my fault.
That's cool. Yeah, aside from the fact that we like Christoph and Benedict, I really like that they have the Drip Widget right there on their homepage. FemtoConf.com, ladies and gentlemen. It's FemtoConf.com. So what are we talking about today?
Well, for today's episode, we are going to be talking about revenue expansion opportunities. And I've been thinking about this a little bit just because it's been on my radar for Bluetick to kind of look at different ways that I can either rework the pricing or find other things to expand the revenue opportunities for Bluetick. And so I started looking into some of the different ways that that could be done, but it also kind of gave me the idea for this particular episode. And what we're going to be talking about is revenue expansion. And revenue expansion is different from revenue growth, which typically comes from new customers. Expansion revenue is any revenue that is generated in excess of whatever the initial purchase price that the customer agreed to pay. So if they signed up for $30 a month and they're paying $30 a month, that's great. That's considered a new customer. It becomes expansion revenue if they move from like a $30 plan to a $50 plan or to a $100 plan, or if they add more users or purchase other services or other products that you have. And there's a bunch of different ways that those types of things factor into it. But the bottom line is, when you're defining expansion revenue, it's really additional revenue that comes from your existing customer base that you would not have gotten otherwise.
Yeah, and the holy grail of running a SaaS app is having enough expansion revenue that you have net negative churn. And I talked about this a few episodes ago, but in essence, you always think of churn as lost revenue because of people canceling. But you can get to the point where if people are naturally upgrading to higher tiers as they use your product, a good example of this being an ESP, where as you add more subscribers, you just, you know, you naturally bump up every few months. If you're having any kind of success, you start paying more. That can be more. That amount can be more than the amount of revenue you're losing because of people canceling. And when you see that effect, it's called net negative churn. And it is, I'll say it's rare. It's becoming more popular is the wrong word, but I'm seeing and hearing about it more as people kind of catch on to how incredible it can be as a flywheel for growth, because having low churn means you can grow at a certain pace, but net negative is like, it like supercharges you. I mean, it's just a completely different trajectory. And if you're lucky enough or smart enough or both to kind of stumble into a business where people automatically have expansion revenue, again, like an ESP, I think web hosting, if you do it based on, you know, maybe traffic or the number of sites, I'm trying to think of other areas where you kind of automatically go, oh, I know, like Wistia for me, you know, we had a small plan and we just keep adding videos and we've gone up. It's not super often, but, you know, maybe once, twice a year, we wind up going up. Mixpanel and Kissmetrics, right? They go based on number of events. So as your website ramps up, you know, you naturally go up the scale. And I guess Help Scout is a good, you know, or any type of support software where it's a per seat. And that's a big one, right? Per seat expansion is interesting because as a company has more success with your product, they are likely to either bring more people in because it's working, right? If they already have employees, they'll add more seats, or they're likely, if they're a startup, like, you know, we went from 2 employees to 8 in the span of about 18 months, and we just needed to add more people to all of our systems. So those are opportunities for some really natural ways to get expansion revenue and to try to get to that holy grail, as I've said, net negative churn. So I hope I didn't steal your thunder. I was kind of going off the top of my head. Did I totally decimate this outline with that diatribe?
No, just the first little piece of it. But we'll link up to, in the show notes, a couple of different blog articles specifically about how new recurring revenue is different from expansion revenue, which is different from churn revenue, and how those can combine to create that negative churn effect. And those blog articles, some of them are from Barometrics or Priced Intelligently, and then there's also another one from geckoboard.com. So you already talked a little bit about why it's important because it relates to negative churn, but the bottom line here with going after revenue expansion is that it helps to offset your existing churn. Because as Rob just said, when you're losing people just on a regular basis, you're going to lose people on a monthly basis or quarterly basis, whatever it is that your billing cycle tends to be on. But that helps to offset that. And it's easier to get more money from your existing customers because presumably you're keeping them happy than it is to acquire new customers. It's typically a lot more expensive to acquire those new customers. You know, we talk about these acronyms like CAC, which is cost to acquire a customer. That number tends to be substantially higher for a new customer than it is to get expansion revenue from an existing customer where you're doing some sort of cross-sell or upsell, or you're asking them to opt into this other thing. It's a lot easier to do those things because you've already built that trust. When they've never purchased anything from you before, they're much more reluctant to take that first step because they're pretty sure that it's going to take up time. And it's not that it's not valuable to them, but they've got other things that they're doing in addition to paying attention to your product and the things that it can do for them. There's only so many hours in the day for them to focus on the things that they need to do, and that adds one more thing to their plate. So let's dive into some of the different ways that you can increase revenue. The first one, Rob kind of alluded to this, where some of the examples he gave out were like Mixpanel or Kissmetrics or hosting providers, where as the customer becomes more successful, they use more of your services, and by virtue of that, they start paying you more because they're using more of the resources that you offer. This is essentially increasing their consumption. And there's another way to look at that, which is to decrease the friction that it requires to use whatever that is as well. So some examples that come to mind are like Apple's iPod or the Fire TV from Amazon. Those things make it a lot easier to download music or to purchase movies or rent movies. All this digital media, those devices make it a lot easier for you to consume them and to consume them at a faster pace. So those are some examples of that. Now, if you go over into the physical products world, this occurred to me a while ago. I'm sure somebody has talked about it at some point, but if you remember going to McDonald's back in the 90s, for example, the straws were insanely small. So if you ever went and got a milkshake, it took you forever to drink the milkshake because the straw was so small. You go to McDonald's now and the straws tend to be substantially larger. They're like probably 6 to 8 times the size that they used to be. You can put through a lot more liquid in there and drink it faster. So that leads you to increasing the rate of consumption. And it also leads to larger portion sizes as well. So you do, as a consumer, you have to be careful. But as a producer of whether it's content or digital assets or something along those lines, if you can increase the rate that somebody is using your product or services by decreasing the amount of friction, that's almost the same thing as just as being able to deliver more.
Another example that McDonald's was, I think kind of a pioneer of, and we'll talk a little bit later about that, is cross-sells. When you'd order a burger, what was the famous saying? Do you want fries with that, right? And because we're trying to encourage you to do that. And then they had meals. I mean, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when you'd go to McDonald's and there were no meals. You ordered a hamburger and then you ordered French fries and then you ordered a drink if you wanted it. But they started packaging the meals to do exactly this, right? Increase consumption of overall amount of food. You could also call it a cross sell. And this, of course, can backfire on you. It's very unlikely to happen to one of us running this small business. But remember that movie Super Size Me? It was kind of a look at, you know, how bad McDonald's food was. I mean, that was the name of it, was a take on, you used to pull up to McDonald's and you'd ask for the meal deal, the Big Mac meal deal. And they'd say, do you want to supersize that for 99 cents? And it was, you get like an extra large drink and an extra large fry or something like that. And that was another way to increase consumption. It was an upsell in essence. And, you know, a lot of people did that. And then there were complaints of like, well, people, you know, you're encouraging people to eat bad food and blah, blah, blah. So kind of the politics of it, or that, you know, I guess the morality or ethics of doing that aside, odds are you're not selling, you know, unhealthy food to folks. And you are probably, you know, doing something like selling software or selling info products or ebooks. And if people use or consume more of them, you can encourage them to do so, then that's going to help increase your bottom line.
The next one is a variation on that, which is increasing the number of seats that people are using. And not every product is going to have a pricing model that's going to be able to support this, but there are certain cases where a per user model makes a lot of sense. And there are ways to incorporate other people onto the team in an environment, whether it's your customer or consulting companies that they use, whether they have contractors. Those people may need user accounts. And you do have to be a little careful with this just because, as I said, the type of product that you have, you can easily end up in situations where people are just sharing an account and you're trying to sell, you know, like a single account for $50 and two accounts for $100 or maybe a slightly reduced price of $90. And they just won't go for it because they'll just decide, well, we don't need that. We'll just share the account between these people. It's not that big a deal. So just be aware that sometimes it's an option and sometimes it's not. But there are opportunities to put people into a software package in other ways, other roles inside of it, or other responsibilities, which give them maybe different options or different features.
There is actually a really good rule for this on how to decide if your product should be seat-based. And the rule is, and this is hard and fast. Like, I know a lot of time we say, this is a guideline. Like, I actually believe that you should not break this one either way. If someone logs into your software with their login, do they see something different than if they log in as someone else? So a good example of that is MailChimp or Drip, an ESP. If I log in, Mike, if you and I share an account and we both log in with our own logins, we see the same thing. There really isn't anything different. The only difference is if I were to log in as you and do an export, you'll get notified, you know, when the export's done, but there's minimal stuff. If I log into a CRM system or into Bluetick as me versus you, it's a completely different inbox, completely different list of customers, completely different list of tasks. And so CRM is the obvious. I mean, CRM always charges by seat, right? Because that's their upsell, and that is the differentiator. And so, you know, it is the minority of products that can charge by seat, but just ask yourself the question, does someone should someone see something different if they log in as a different person? You know, Trello is another example. If I log into my Trello account versus yours, they're totally different. So if we had a business account with seats, you should absolutely charge by seat. I do see people make the mistake, you mentioned this, of trying to charge by seat when they don't have the differentiator. And then you just get one seat and save it with everybody because there's no difference, right? It doesn't make sense. And it feels to people like you're being disingenuous if you did do that. I can't imagine like an ESP charging by seat. Now, there are some marketing automation platforms that charge by seat because they have CRM built into them. Infusionsoft, ActiveCampaign are examples of that. So they do have per seat pricing, but I'm almost positive if they did not have that CRM view that they would not do per seat stuff.
The next option for increasing your revenue is to have different upsells. And these could either be a higher tier of an existing product, or it could be add-ons. It could be additional integrations that you give people access to. It could be plugins. There's a variety of different options that you could give somebody that provide additional functionality beyond the base level package that you could use as an upsell opportunity. And if you're using these, you can either have like bundle deals on your website where you just say, hey, here's a package deal and it's $100 for these X things. Or you can say, well, a la carte, you can get each of these if you want, each of these five, but it's going to cost you $30 a piece if you buy them individually. Buy them as a bundle, you can get them for $100. So that bundling is also an option for an upsell. It doesn't seem like it is, but when you start looking at who the types of people are that are buying those things, chances are good that they're not going to use all five of them in that particular example. They're going to use maybe three or four. But the package deal is appealing to them because they have in their head that, oh, I might use these things down the road. And even if they don't use them now, they may have intent to use them later. Whether they do or not is kind of immaterial, but you can get them to purchase that package deal, whether or not they're going to use it, especially if you position it as a good deal for them.
Yeah. And this one, I mean, this is very different. You know, there's upsells. It's different between info products and software. Upsells are very natural and tend to make a lot of sense with information. If someone's going to buy a book from you, then you upsell them to the videos, or you upsell them to a 30-minute consult or some interviews you did. I mean, it's pretty natural. Software can be more of a challenge. It can take more effort. You can always upsell training, really hardcore training. I mean, you don't just want documentation to be upsold, right? You want that to be free. But something that actually gives someone a mindset view or an architectural kind of overview that they would normally have to pay for. There's that line of, you know, you look at pricing of segment.com, their tiers are less based on usage and much more based on the integrations that you use. And I'm sure they know that someone integrating with Salesforce tends to have bigger budgets and get a lot more value out of Segment than someone not doing that. Zapier, I think, is the same way. There's certain things that are locked behind higher priced paywalls. Drip tends to be that in these kind of apps that integrate with a lot of things, because I know if someone is using Drip, they're probably a more sophisticated marketer. They probably have a larger list. They probably have, you know, a bigger budget, that types of stuff. And they're going to get a lot of value out of these tools. So there is, this takes a lot of thought. That the hard part about this is knowing what to lock behind these feature gates, and doing it incorrectly is pretty easy. I've seen it swing both ways. And I do think that if you find one of these other paths where your expansion revenue can be based on number of seats, or it can be based on, you know, number of subscribers or contacts, or it can be based on number of events, you know, there's certain things you can kind of fit in, storage size, you know, if you're Amazon S3, right? Then go with those and probably stay away from trying to feature gate right now. Feature gating meaning you can't get this feature unless you go up a tier, you pass through this gate by paying more money. But if you don't have an obvious way to use one of those obvious numbers that kind of everyone else is using, or that really just makes sense for your product, then yes, you do need to seriously start thinking about ways to have, how do you build tiers when you don't really have, you know, an easy one number like seats or subscribers or contacts to look at.
That's actually a really interesting kind of discussion topic, just because I think that people look at those features and say, well, what should I put in here as a feature gate to create these different pricing tiers? And I remember when Segment used to feature gate based on which integrations you were doing, because presumably if you were using Salesforce, you had the money to pay for Salesforce, so clearly you had money to pay more for a Segment license. But I think that they've shifted their pricing model, and you don't have to do that anymore. Like when you sign up, they have three tiers.
Yeah, I was just saying that they did. I was mistaken. Now Zapier still does that, but yeah, Segment used to. You're correct. I don't have a limitation. Yep.
Yep. Yep, they used to do that. They don't do that anymore. But I think that's partially because they got to a point where they were far enough down the road that they had the ability to dedicate somebody to taking a hard look at those things and seeing whether or not they mattered, and having the conversations with the customers to try and find out what the more optimal pricing model was for them.
So they do it now on monthly tracked users, MTUs they call it, which can be dicey. Although with Segment, that makes sense, right? It's like, how many users are you going to track in a given month? That's actually pretty easy to get an idea of. I mean, you kind of think of how many other customers or how many website visitors unique in a month. Other times you'll see, like Amazon has pricing like this where it's like number of elastic compute units. And it's like, what does that even mean? You know, that's not actually a core. It's like something that is like not defined anywhere. Or I've seen things based on events and it's like, well, I don't know how many events I'm going to have in a month. How am I going to know that? And so that's where, that's like Kissmetrics and Mixpanel have that problem of like trying to define what these things are.
Even Segment has that problem because like the MTUs that they advertise, that is for the number of tracked users coming to your site, not necessarily the people logging in. So it's not your team. It's, you know, like if your website suddenly gets a ton of traffic from Reddit or Slashdot or something like that, you could easily blow through that very quickly. Now, depending on the company, like you could either end up in a world of trouble with a giant bill, or they could say, we're going to turn this off, or we're not going to allow you access to the rest of this data unless you pay for it.
Right. Now, something that Segment is, I'm looking at not the pricing grid at the top, but they have a breakdown of like what the differences are between kind of the plan limit levels. And I actually, without knowing how, you know, what their internal data looks like, they both have MTUs, that's monthly tracked users, plus they have seats. So like the lower end only has one seat and the team one has 10 seats. And I go back to my question. If I log into Segment as you versus me, do I see something different? Because as far as I know, you don't. So I actually think that's probably not a good idea. And then they have sources, which is how many sources are you going to connect to Segment, right? And the developer plan only has two, and then all the others have unlimited. So maybe that one's harder to say right or wrong. But in general, especially like when you're first starting out, and you don't have the trust of the market, you don't have a brand name, you look at people like Segment or Intercom or, you know, MailChimp or Drip, and we have the luxury of having a brand name and people actually seeking us out, and we can raise our prices and we can do more complex pricing schemes because people are willing to come and use a tool that they trust and that a lot of people are talking about. In the early days, and this was with Drip as well as Intercom, as well as your tool today, I'm speaking to the listener there, you don't have the luxury of being able to have super complex pricing because no one's going to want to bother with it because you're probably really struggling to try to get people to come and try it out and try to use it. So I would go extremely simple and I would go for one of these numbers, you know, per seat, per subscriber, per contact, or something else that's very noticeable and easy to figure out until you get to that critical mass. And you're going to know it by the fact that people are going to start telling you, boy, you should raise your prices, or boy, you're too cheap, or you're going to look around and say, I haven't raised my prices in a year. I need to rethink this, you know, and you should have pretty good flywheel growth by the time you get to that. Drip is now on its fourth version. You know, we have versioning for pricing, and we're on our fourth version of it. In 4 years. We haven't done it every year on the dot, but we actually did it three times in the first probably year and a half or something. And then we really haven't done any restructuring of pricing since then. But, you know, do try to keep it simple in the early days and don't try to copy companies that are way further along because they have the momentum and the flywheel and the brand and you don't have that yet. And so you don't want to make this mistake of confusing people.
You know, everything that we just talked about is really adjusting your licensing model in order to create more opportunities for upsells using those pricing tiers. Another option that you have that's available to you is offering some sort of an annual plan. So whether you offer it upfront or you offer it a couple of months down the road after somebody has started using your product and is getting comfortable with it, maybe there's certain trigger points where you say, hey, let's offer them an annual plan or some sort of a special discount upgrade for maybe it's a 3-month upgrade or, hey, try this out the platinum tier for free for 30 days or 90 days or something like that. There's different ways that you can kind of position that and pitch it to people. But you really, what you're trying to do is you're trying to increase that overall revenue from them so that it decreases the number of times that they're going to have to sit down and think about, do I really want to continue paying for this? And I think LeadPages used to do that really well with their webinars, where if you attended a webinar, you could sign up for a LeadPages account and they would pitch you on a 2-year plan. So for 2 years, you're probably not going to go look for another landing page provider because you have this account still. And unless it's not doing what you needed to do, you're not going to go look for something else because you've already purchased it.
Yeah, and one of the big benefits of annual plans, especially when you're starting out, is you're tight on cash, and to get someone to pay for 12 months of service in advance, even with a discount, that cash is invaluable. And if you can figure out a way to get someone to pay you for that full amount of service and you're doing any type of paid acquisition, you are going to be in a great spot to basically spend a dollar, get $3 or $4 right away, and it is a flywheel that allows you to then acquire more people faster. Like it's pretty incredible the power of, you know, being able to get annual. And that's why you'll see pretty hefty discounts, 20, 30, 40% on annual plans, because the cash is just so important to cash starved startups in the early days.
So we've mentioned this next one in the, several times throughout the episode, but it would be cross sells. So if you have other products that you have to offer, cross selling them after somebody has purchased a first product, if there's another one that relates to it or integrates with it, if there are signatures that you can identify with the customer that would indicate that they would probably be a good fit for this other product that you have, then there's obviously ways that you would want to interject yourself into a conversation with them to put them in an email campaign or have somebody call them and say, hey, would you possibly be interested in taking a look at this over here? Because we think that this would help your business as well, based on what you're doing and what we've seen other customers get in terms of benefits and, you know, the similarities between the customers. So that's another one. But could I move on from that? The next one is services and customizations. And I think this one's a key piece that most software people overlook, because we're trying to build software companies. So our natural inclination is to build a software and sell people software. But the reality is sometimes people need a little extra help, whether that's onboarding assistance or they need you to do something for them, whether it's a productized service. You know, there's lots of different pieces to your application. It's not just signing up for it and plugging it in a credit card. There's usually a lot of other things that the customer is going to have to do in order to get the value out of that particular product. And because you have all the insights and the back-end knowledge and domain expertise for that particular product, you can do those things a lot more efficiently than the customer can. So you can create a service that is going to use your product on their behalf to achieve whatever the goal is. And now you're able to do a lot more because you can dig into the guts of it. And if something's not going to work the way it's written, you can find ways around it. You can import things directly into the database if you need to, and then make the software do it so that you can deliver on that service that you've promised them. And they're more likely to purchase those services because it provides a lot more value to them by having it as a more of a done-for-you service rather than they sign up and it's self-service. Because that's what most of what SaaS applications are. Most of them are self-service versus a productized service where you're hiring somebody to do something or deliver some sort of a value or output, and that's what you're paying them for. You're paying them for the output. With SaaS, you're paying them for the license to use that tool for the duration of them paying for it, but they still have to do the work.
Yeah, I think there are two aspects to this. You know, you said like services, so it's kind of like the productized service, right? And then there's a second aspect, which is customizations. And it'd be like if someone, you know, came to us. Actually, people used to do this with .NET Invoice all the time. They wanted to, it was downloadable software, you ran on your own server, and it was kind of like having, it was like self-hosted FreshBooks, like a simpler version of that. And people would buy it, and then they'd say, oh, I want this thing added. And we're like, yeah, we're not going to build that feature. And they're like, well, can I pay you to add it? And at first it was like, yeah, you know, we'll charge $150 an hour. And then we moved it up to $200 an hour because we just really didn't want to do them. And it made some money, but it was a hassle, right? Consulting is just, if you want to be in that business, go do it. It's lucrative, you know, in the short term. But it's like, if you want to build something long term, it's hard to mix those kinds of businesses because they're two different businesses, like serving clients, offering deadlines, doing the contracts. What if they're not happy with it? What if they request changes? It's like, that's a type of business. And then building your own software product is another type. And you're not going to move forward full steam on your software product if you're busy doing a bunch of consulting gigs. And the problem is the consulting gigs are like the quick hit, right? It's like the crack cocaine where you get the five or the 10 grand, someone wants you to do something. So of course you're going to run off and do that. But that revenue isn't worth nearly as much because it's dollars for hours and you're not making it. You're not spending that time marketing your product and building features that other people will use. And so even, you know, the market itself speaks, like if you were to go raise venture funding or you were to try to sell your company, you know, even like through a broker, or you were to go public or whatever, any type of valuation, software recurring revenue is going to be, let's say, 3 to 7x, you know, your revenue multiple. And consulting revenue tends to be in the 1, maybe 2x if you're lucky. Like it is a third to a fourth as valuable on the open market because it's just how these things work. So I think you have to be really careful about taking the quick hit, you know, or the quick dollar, because it is going to slow you down. And if you're super desperate and you really need the cat, you know, there's times when it's not an absolute rule. There are times when you might need to do this, but I advise founders against doing this if at all possible.
And the last item on our list for revenue expansion opportunities is to have an affiliate offer. And this could be in the form of a direct product that you are offering that is a third-party product that you are getting a commission from, or it could be a referral. So if you have a good relationship with a provider and there's a subset of customers that you know need something, you're probably not going to do it, but you have a good relationship with somebody who does provide that service or that type of product, then you could set up an affiliate relationship with them where you will refer customers over to them, where you'll get some sort of a commission or kickback or finder's fee, something along those lines for referring them over. Now, you could also do this for free. I know that there are people out there who like those types of things and they'll just say, hey, you just here's some free business because I know that you're going to take care of them and I don't really want anything from it. And those opportunities are available as well. You can probably find people who will do the same thing for you. But I think it's much more common to have some sort of an affiliate relationship set up so that there is a specific dollar amount tied to it or percentage so that it makes it easier for you to quantify how much work and effort it's going to take you.
If you have other ideas for revenue expansion that you feel like we missed in today's episode, feel free to come to startupsfortherestofus.com, episode 365, post a comment, or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. That wraps us up for the day. You can also call our voicemail at 888-801-9690. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Outta Control. It's by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.